Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He's also a noted educator, historian, author, and curator whose career in museums spans nearly 30 years. In addition to teaching at several universities, Bunch has worked at the National Museum of American History, the California African American Museum, and the National Air and Space Museum. He came to his current position after serving as president of the Chicago Historical Society. Lonnie Bunch, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So when you first go on to the National Museum of African American History and Culture's website, there's a quote from you, and it says, "The African American experience is the lens through which we understand what it is to be an American." What did you mean by that?
What I was struck by is that when people said, let's build an African-American museum, they said to me, let's build a museum that is the best black museum in the world. And I really felt that was unbelievably limiting, because the African-American experience in many ways is the quintessential American experience, that when you want to understand our core values of spirituality, resiliency, or optimism, or when you want to understand how do you make people believe in a country that didn't believe in them? So in my mind, the African-American experience was the best way, the best lens to understand what it means to be an American, what the strengths are, what the weaknesses are, what the future possibilities were.
And did that seem counterintuitive to people because it is a separate museum?
Well, I mean, I think there was always a lot of conversation about, okay, should there be a separate museum? Would only black people come to this museum? And by framing it as the quintessential American story, it's become a pilgrimage site for all kinds of Americans, regardless of race. And while it was counterintuitive, it seemed to me to be unbelievably logical. And that, in essence, it's almost like saying, you know, there are hundreds of Civil War battlefield sites, right? And each site tells a local story, but ultimately it tells the bigger story of the Civil War. To me, this museum was using one story, one lens, to tell a bigger story.
And the museum recently celebrated its one-year anniversary. Congratulations.
It's hard to believe.
But since it's opened, you've welcomed more than 3.6 million people.
Yeah, we expected 4,000 people a day. We're getting 8,000 people a day. What has really been most humbling has really been two factors. One is that people spend so much time in the museum. The average time in a Smithsonian Museum people spend is an hour and a half. They're spending 5 to 6 to 7 hours in this museum. But maybe even more importantly to me is that our recent survey suggests that 25% of the people who come to the museum have never been to another museum in their lives. So we're suddenly opening new doors, introducing cultural possibilities to new generations of Americans, and that's exciting to me.
You've said you were surprised that it became a place of pilgrimage for people so early on. What else about this first year has surprised you?
Well, I think while I never tried to craft a museum that was a place that said, if you're in, you're important, and if you're not, you're not important. But that's been the way people have begun to see this, and it's become the great legitimizer, and I didn't expect that. I think that while the response has been overwhelmingly positive, I always get these calls or emails, you know, you've left out X or you've left out Y, and I guess that surprised me. I think the other thing that really has surprised me is that the museum has stimulated a conversation about history in America, helping people understand that history matters, and that the things we see today, the debates over the politics of memory, some of that occurs because this museum has helped people to understand that history is important. And so I'm pleased, but surprised.
And speaking of that history, I mean, you've been working to bring this museum into existence for more than a decade, but the attempts to bring a museum like this started back in the 1900s. Can you talk about what finally moved the process along from early origins in 1915 to, you know, 2016?
I think several things. I think, first of all, you had traditionally, whenever this idea came forward, it was either owned by the Republicans or owned by the Democrats. That in the late 90s and early 2000s, John Lewis worked with people, the former civil rights leader, worked with people from both sides of the aisle, conservative Republicans as well. And so suddenly you had a bipartisan effort for the first time. But also, I would argue it worked because you now had 50 or 60 years of brilliant scholarship. You had the work of John Hope Franklin and others. And so the Smithsonian is a place that runs on scholarship. And so now you had the kind of work where people could say, oh, that is an important story, or that has been vetted and debated. And I guess the final reason is that you had an array of people, black, white, Latino, who had resources, who said, this is an important story, and I will contribute to that. So all of that sort of made this come to fruition.
And that was not a small amount of money that you needed to raise.
You know, when I left the city of Chicago, I think I had raised something like $26 million. And I remember thinking, and that's the most money anybody ever needs to raise in their life. We had to raise, all told, in federal and private, $570 million. When I took the job, I told my mother I was taking this job, and somehow fundraising came up, and I said, oh, I don't know how much, but it's going to be, you know, hundreds of millions. And she said, that's more money than God can count. And I remember thinking many a time during this process, why did I say yes?
Well, and as you know, WPSU produced a documentary called Holding History about historian and collector Charles Bloxon, who donated several items belonging to Harriet Tubman to the museum, including her hymnal and shawl. And you've described that moment when he first showed those items to you. You said that you were brought to tears. Why did those artifacts have such resonance with you?
When you try to build a museum and you try to envision the stories you can tell, you think, well, there's no material on Harriet Tubman. And how do I bring this woman to life? How do I capture the myths, but more importantly, capture the reality? And so when Charles Bloxon called me and said he had material from Harriet Tubman, as much as I respected him, I figured he's got to be wrong. And so when I went up to see him in Philadelphia and he started pulling things out, I was overwhelmed by what I saw, that it existed, but it existed in a way that allowed us to make Harriet Tubman whole. And that just moved me. And then when, you know, they pulled out that hymnal, that even though Harriet Tubman couldn't read, it was a hymnal that had all those spirituals that she would sing when she went into the South, you know, Steal Away Jesus, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And I could then imagine Harriet Tubman doing that. And then pulling out that shawl, which was so personal, and the fact that there's a picture of her 3 days before she died wrapped in that shawl, at that point I lost it. At that point I really knew, because this was early in the process, that really helped me believe we could do this. If we could find material on Harriet Tubman, if Charles Bloxon could say to us, not only do I have this, but it's yours, that made me believe that we could find other amazing artifacts.
And I wonder if there's something about, you know, I think people in history can become these almost mythical figures. Is there something about having something tangible that moves them to being like, these were real people?
I think that the artifact is unbelievably powerful on several levels. On the one hand, it makes those no longer with us concrete, right? Whether you can see the things that move them or that shape them. But the other thing that's so powerful about it is that an artifact like the shawl or the hymnal allows people who maybe don't know the story, maybe are even uncomfortable, of different races, they'll come together and they'll look at that object. And then you see them talking to each other. It really brings conversation. It gives people the opportunity, the permission to really cross lines and share stories. So that's why, to me, it was so powerful and so important for us to not only use technology and oral histories, but to find the stuff of history.
And it was important to you to also have the lives of everyday people represented in this museum. Why was that important?
Well, you know, I'm a product of my training. I was trained to be a social historian, which meant that while I was very interested in the Frederick Douglasses and the George Washingtons and the Abraham Lincoln, I was interested in the people whose names we don't know. And so partly for me, I've always felt my job as a historian was to give voice to the anonymous and make visible the invisible. And so this museum became a way to, yes, tell the story of the great people, Frederick Douglass and Fannie Lou Hamer and Martin Luther King and Sojourner Truth, but it also became the place where we can see stories through the lens of average people. So when we look at the story of, oh, a man who gained his freedom in the 1850s and he realized how important that paper was, that he made a handmade tin wallet, that he was able to protect that, and then every night he would come home and share with his family the importance of freedom. And so that allows us to tell a story through a different lens. And in a way, what you hope is that it stimulates all Americans to recognize how important their history is. It may not all be in a national museum, but it's important to share with your family to preserve that cultural patrimony.
And that item that you just described, that tin wallet with the freedom papers, you can also see that online on the mobile app.
Yes.
Why was it important for you to have a digital presence as well as a physical presence?
If we had built this museum 20 years ago, I knew exactly how to do a traditional bricks and mortar building. But we realized we were going to be the first Smithsonian Museum to be born digital. So we had to think about, what does that mean? Both in terms of beginning our work before we collected things, doing exhibits online. But also what it really meant was, for many people, they've only grown up with the virtual. And we found that we can use technology as a way to introduce people. But many people who grew up, you know, my daughter's age or younger, suddenly are fascinated by the authentic. So what we wanted to do was find the right tension between innovation and tradition. And so it was really important for us to realize that while we'll have millions of people who will come to the museum, millions more will never get there. And I'm proudest of the fact that we probably serve 40 million people based on our online presence. So it really allows us to be the kind of educational engine that I think a good Smithsonian Museum should be.
You wrote an article in 1992 where you say, museums and curators must have the courage and vision needed to embrace controversy. You wrote that more than 20 years ago. How does the National Museum of African American History and Culture embrace this idea of controversy?
You know, it's interesting. Getting to run this museum really allowed me to try all the things I believed in, right, that I've written about. And I said to people, if you don't want to deal with controversy, if you don't want to deal with difficult issues, don't build this museum. Because as John Hope Franklin, who was the advisor and the head of our scholarly advisory committee, used to always say to me, he'd always whisper in my ear, we'd sit next to each other at these meetings, and he'd always say two things. Lonnie, tell the unvarnished truth. And Lonnie, don't be afraid to tell the unvarnished truth. So we realize that people are not going to always like the interpretation or like the stories we tell, but what we feel is we have a commitment, both to scholarship, but also to the people that live this lives, to tell the stories in ways that aren't controversial for controversy's sake, but that really say, in some ways, the museum has an expectation of its visitors. The expectation is that you'll work a little, that you won't come to this museum for simple answers for complex questions. What you'll do is you'll come to this museum to find ambiguity, nuance, and if we can do that, not only do you learn history, but you learn to begin to engage in a way that allows for controversy not to be something that scares us, but controversy is something that makes us better.
And you mentioned that you had a fear, and it even went into the way that you designed the building, that this museum would be a target for terrorism. Where did those fears come from, and does that shape in any way this idea of controversy and being willing?
Well, I think that we knew, as we did research and looked at websites and the like, we realized that this would be the Smithsonian Museum considered most at risk for domestic terrorism. And so we just needed to be careful because we wanted to protect our collections, our staff, and most importantly, our visitors. And so we had to think a little bit about how do you harden the glass of the building and make that stronger in case of blast. We have all these amazing things that stop cars from crashing into the building and the like. But also, you know, somebody left a noose in the museum near an exhibit looking at the Ku Klux Klan. So what it reminded us is, one, that we're all vulnerable, but two, it reminded us how important it is to have this museum, that if there are people who don't want it to happen, who are very critical of it, that's the very reason why you build this museum. So we're not held captive by any fear, but we're cognizant of the realities of the world we live in.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Our guest is Lonnie Bunch, founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. There's the state of race relations in this country has recently resurfaced to the top of America's consciousness. I'm not sure it ever went away, but it's pretty prominent now. White supremacists are openly marching. There are violent protests. Is this time reminiscent of other times in our past?
Oh, I think there are many times where, in essence, we tend to think of America as a linear march to progress, right? That you make change and then you build on that change. But the reality is that equally powerful of any time of change was, while there were people pushing America to live up to its stated ideals, there were people who also equally powerful who were trying to remain an America that wasn't free, that wasn't fair. And so what you see now is really this amazing fight for the soul of America. And that what it reminds us as a historian is that the struggle is never over. And that one has to realize that as difficult as the moment is, people have been through difficult moments and organized, struggled. Yes, there was sacrifice, loss of life, so it's not easy. But the reality is that people died to make America better. And I think that what I hope is when people go through the museum, they have a commitment to demanding America live up to its stated ideals, a commitment to respect all these people on whose shoulders we stand, who fought big battles and little battles. And so ultimately, this is about holding a country accountable and demanding that America, as Langston Hughes once said, let America be America again.
There's also been a lot of discussion recently about whether Confederate statues should be removed. What are your feelings about the way that we should treat those and other relics that people find really painful?
Well, I think the Confederate statues, to my mind, is an interesting and maybe a separate issue. I think that the Confederate statues remind us that the South lost the war but won the peace, and that in many ways these statues were less about the Civil War and more about an uncivil peace. And so what I would argue is, as a historian whose work in African American history was often erased or undervalued, I am loath to erase history. But what I feel strongly is that we need accurate history, so that if you're going to have these statues, then contextualize them. Help us understand what they tell us, how these statues were really ways people said, we will not change. We will not be America that's fair. And why these statues became so prominent during the late 19th century when Jim Crow becomes the law of the land, and also why they show up during the civil rights era as a way to protest racial change. So my notion is that if you want to take them down, my favorite thing is there's a park in Budapest where they put together all the statues that were once the Soviet era statues. And they said they shaped our history. So let's not lose that, but let's contextualize. Let's talk about that. So as a historian, my notion is always give people the accurate, unvarnished truth, and use these statues as a way to do that.
I've heard you talk about the importance of the museum being as much in the present and the future as the past. How do you and your staff, because I know it takes a big team to keep this museum going, how do you try to make that a reality?
I think what we do is look at how our exhibitions, how our programs can really help people understand that Ferguson was not the first time something like that happened, and that these things will continue to happen, but there have been historic ways to confront them. Not that I'm saying the answers are all in the past. What I'm saying is that you can't be sure that Black Lives Movement, Black Lives Matters movement works unless you understand where it's coming from and understanding the history of building on that. We then look at two things. One is we spend a lot of time today thinking about what would be stories that scholars or curators would want to explore 50 years from now. So we really look at let's collect today, because when we began the museum, we were collecting yesterday to fill the building. But now it's what do we do to make sure that even if I never do it or even the curators that work for me never tell certain stories, but somebody 30, 40 years from now will say, you know what, looking back at the era of Donald Trump, the statues are really important. So thank God the museum collected a statue. You know, so it's that kind of thing. And then really looking at creating both online activities and public programs that allow us to grapple with the most important issues we face. You know, we bring in people like Ta-Nehisi Coates to talk about his interpretation of where we are, so that in essence, the building has become this platform of possibility where you can bring the smartest thinkers, you can grapple with the most difficult issues, hopefully to create an educated audience that will use that education to demand America live up to its ideals.
I read somewhere that if you had not become a historian, you would have been a filmmaker. First of all, there's still time, so I hope you don't give up on that. But also, I find that interesting because at their core, they're very similar. So researching, understanding people, and ultimately telling a story. So what made you choose this career over that one?
You know, I loved history so much, and I loved film so much. My dad was going to graduate school when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, so I rarely saw him. And he would come back late at night, and he was so keyed up from studying at Hunter College in New York that he'd watch old movies on TV. So I would sneak downstairs, and we'd watch old movies together. And he began to deconstruct what was happening. And I was like, how does he know that? He probably saw the movie 10 times. But, you know, as a kid, you're fascinated. And so I've always loved movies. I've always taught it. And I really made some bad documentaries in my career, really bad. But I think that in another life, filmmaking is so much similar to the work of museums. In fact, I always try to encourage my staff, especially my curatorial staff, to take film writing classes, to think about how do you write visually? Because unlike a book, an exhibition is a visual medium like film. So I love that. And I also use that when I thought about the building. How do we create the drama, the pacing, the juxtapositions that make film so strong? So in some way, there's a kind of cinematic edge to the museum.
What should we know about what makes you quintessentially who you are that's outside of your work in museums?
That I am somebody who was blessed to have family members who made choices that transformed a family's trajectory. So I'm a big believer in, obviously, education, and a big believer, however, of fighting the good fight to demand a country be what it should be. The other thing that people need to know about me is I'm really competitive. I'm an old jock. I hate to lose. So often during this process, I would sit and say, I'm not going to lose this battle. What do I have to do to win? I guess the other thing that is what shapes me is, candidly, I know it sounds trite, but I married well. I've had a career that forced us, allowed us to live in many places, to do important work, but I needed a family that was comfortable with that. And as I've said often, when it came to taking this job, I actually sat down with my family, my wife, my daughters, and said, okay, if I do this, what does this mean to us? What does it mean, its impact on my own life? And we came as a family and said, okay, this is worth doing. So I am a sucker for movies. I'll watch any movie all the time. And in fact, when I asked my wife to marry me, we talked about all these issues like, you know, children, religion. I said, the most important thing is, will you go to the movies with me every week? And when she said yes, I said, let's get married.
Well, you also, in that conversation with your family, I mean, you had to think about health issues too.
Yeah, yeah.
I was struck by, you spoke to Penn State students the other night, that you said, you know, you had to ask yourself, if this job took years off your life, was it worth it? Were those tough conversations to have?
Very much so, because I know me. I know that I don't know how to not be all in, right? As I've said to somebody recently, I realized that for 11 years, there was an awakening moment that I didn't think about this museum. No matter what I was doing, at some point it would come back in. And even though I like to pretend because now it's so successful, it was so hard to do, that the kind of daily stress. And so, yes, we talked a lot about that. In fact, I've really argued that people who take important positions downplay the impact of stress, and they ought not to. So people understand what they're getting into when they take these kind of jobs.
There must have been points where you thought, this is, I don't know why I'm doing this.
Oh, there were many points. And, you know, as I always said, 8 o'clock in the morning, the best job in America. 2 o'clock in the morning, the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life, right? And because it was both, not just because it was hard, because it was so important that you didn't want to screw this up. If they've been, people have been working on this, dreaming for this, hoping for it for 100 years, and you've been given this calling in a way, how to make sure you don't mess it up. And I think for me, it was really looking back to my own family, to ancestors I'll never know, and thinking, I really want them to smile. I want them to feel that their story has been treated with respect and visibility. And that's really my parameter of success. If I thought my ancestors were smiling, then we did a good job.
You have said that a primary goal of the museum is to help America find whatever peace it can over issues of race. At this moment in our history with the current events, do you think it can still do that?
I think it's more important than ever to try to do that. It's not easy. There's no simple answer. But I think that clarity, candor, unvarnished truths are the first steps to finding reconciliation and healing.
Lonnie Bunch, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He's also a noted educator, historian, author, and curator whose career in museums spans nearly 30 years. In addition to teaching at several universities, Bunch has worked at the National Museum of American History, the California African American Museum, and the National Air and Space Museum. He came to his current position after serving as president of the Chicago Historical Society. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Shereen Stanford, WPSU.